I'm Baba for Pacifica Radio.
I'm Muiza Muntali, host of Africa Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
In Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. In Distrito Colombia, here on this Friday, May 23rd, 2025. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show, and of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on Venezuela by discussing the demonization of Venezuelan migrants, unlawful deportations without due process, and the fact versus fiction on the Tren de Aragua narrative in corporate media, and the Venezuelan right-wingers who set some of these chains of events in motion. And so today on the show, we have the honor and the pleasure of having Maria Paez Victor. She's a Venezuelan-born sociologist living in Canada. Her recent article in Counterpunch is entitled, Where Are the Defenders of the Human Rights of Venezuelans? She joins us from Toronto, Canada today. Welcome to the show, Maria Paez Victor.
Well, Oscar, thank you so much for inviting me to your program. I feel really honored for this opportunity to be able to speak to you and through you to the good people of the United States.
Absolutely. Thank you as well for being on the show with us. And just as I mentioned something that we discussed before we started recording, there is a whole tsunami of misinformation with regards to Venezuela, Venezuelan migrants, and of course the Tren de Aragua narrative that has really fomented fear and paranoia here in the U.S. But I want to begin with your recent Counterpunch article, because you made a bold statement on the Tren de Aragua narrative in the U.S. with the following, quote, in September of 2023, combined forces of the Venezuelan police and military arrested, disbanded, and eliminated the local thugs called Tren de Aragua. At the same time, the authorities cleaned out Tocoron prison in the state of Aragua and retook control from the gangs. The leaders were captured, and those few that escaped had Interpol warrants issued against them. End quote. Long story short, this gang that has become the source of fear and paranoia in the U.S., whether it be the government or in corporate media, seems to be almost non-existent, according to your article. Can you expand on this argument against the corporate media narrative? Because this is quite a bold statement to make, and it's one of the things that compelled me to have you on the show today.
Well, thank you. You know, I followed this, and I think the whole country followed it, because it was so amazing. There was this prison, a pretty large prison, called Tocoron in Aragua, and all kinds of criminal things were happening around there. It turns out that it was being run by the prisoners. The prisoners had taken over this prison, and it was their headquarters for all kinds of horrible things like blackmail and killing people and drugs. And they had turned, and this is, in a sense, it sounds funny, but it really isn't. They turned the prison into like a hotel. It was like a hotel instead of a prison. They had a pool. They had a nursery school for their kids. They had hairdressers. They had everything that you can imagine in a gigantic sort of spa. And of course, they were armed to the teeth, because the arms entered and went the same thing as the drugs. Well, they kept this kind of quiet. And then when the authorities realized, my goodness, a prison is being run by the prisoners because of all of the malfeasance that they were doing in the area. Well, 11,000 security personnel went in there. This was a mix of military and police. And they went in there to clean this out. Now, I must say, and please permit me to say this, as a Venezuelan, I felt so proud of those armed people, because I would have expected that there was going to be a gunfight, that they were going to, you know, kill each other, you know, and there wasn't a gunfight. This was amazing. First of all, because there were some people in there, who, like women, and there were also children in there. And what the police did was this sort of new type of policing where you talk to them and you talk to them and you calm them down and told them, look, we're 11,000. You're completely surrounded. Please give yourself up. And it was through that kind of sort of pacific policing that they got all of these guys. They got them, and they did not kill them. They did not put them against the wall and shoot them and whatever. But a few did escape, and those that escaped, immediately the government called Interpol and said who they were and that they had escaped. So this was a very impressive operation where there was no wild gun battle or killings. And what happened was that, and again, I'm telling you, I feel very proud of the authorities, but I feel very ashamed of the leaders of the opposition of Venezuela, because, and I'm going to tell you, they are fascists. I'm not saying this as an adjective. I am not insulting them. I'm not saying this as an exaggeration, but Maria Corina Machado, Leopoldo López, Borges, this pandilla Guaido, although Guaido is so stupid, I don't think he even understands what fascism is. But these people are so right-wing and fascist that they came up with this idea. They came up with the idea to sell this to the United States. And so what they did, they called Ted Cruz, and they called this Marco Rubio. I'm sorry that you have someone of that type there. And they said, this is an international terrorist group. These guys were thugs. You know, these were local matones, as we say, okay? And so they said, they are an international terrorist group. And furthermore, the government of Maduro has introduced these people into the United States with the migrants. Now, this is a double betrayal. Not only did these leaders of the opposition, by the way, leaders of the opposition outside the country, because they can't go back anyway.
Before you continue, I just want to add that in your Counterpunch article, you specifically mentioned a 2024 meeting between Texas Senator Ted Cruz and several of these right-wing Venezuelan opposition leaders that you mentioned. So, of course, I want you to continue. Could you tell us how a meeting like the one that you mentioned with people like Ted Cruz set the false Tren de Aragua narrative in motion? You also mentioned Marco Rubio as well, but there's a third character here that I would like to mention, and that's Maria Elvira Salazar.
Oh, yes, she's
from Florida, who is also as nefarious as Cruz, as Rubio.
Yes.
And as recently as January or February of last year, was pushing for more anti-Venezuelan legislation. But please continue.
And so was Corina Machado. Now, this is, as I said, a double betrayal. Not only have these people betrayed Venezuela, they betrayed these migrants. Remember, La Machado and this Salazar and all of these people were the ones who told these people to come to the United States, who got the Biden administration to open the doors to them so that they could easily. It's not easy to migrate to the United States. You have to go through all kinds of red tape. These people were told, oh, come, come. You know, we want you here. And then when they're here, this woman and the Salazar and Rubio and all of those started saying, with these migrants, the Maduro government has introduced criminals to the United States. The Maduro government, who just cleaned them all off, and the ones that escaped called Interpol about it. And so this was a double betrayal by these people. Well, this was backed by something called Insight Crime, which is an NGO in the United States, which is financed by the State Department. This was backed by the Washington Post, by Marco Rubio, by CNN, by Fox, by The Economist. They all contributed to the myth of this non-existent organized terrorist crime organization. And so the outrageous lie became newsworthy. And that's why President Trump went on, you know, TV and said, Venezuela is sending its criminals to the United States. He didn't invent this. These people told the president this lie, you know. So what has happened that, and I feel very sorry for them. I pray for them every night, because what happened to them is exactly what happened to the Jews in the pogroms of Tsarist Russia in the 1800s. The same thing that the Nazis did to the Jews in Germany. They went out and grabbed them, these people without uniforms, with masks on their face, grabbed these people from their homes, from schools, from their place of work. They could not say anything in their defense. There was no trial. There was no lawyers. And let me tell you, when I say this in my article, the butchers of Nazi Germany after the war had the right to a trial in Nuremberg and to have lawyers defend them. But Venezuelans in the United States did not merit habeas corpus, did not merit a lawyer, did not merit having a trial. So they were grabbed without evidence. Some of them had tattoos. You know how youth are now. Now the youth always puts tattoos of all sorts. Well, if they had any tattoo, the tattoo. I don't know where they got this. This is ridiculous.
Yes.
And so these people were beaten, their heads shaved. They were sold to El Salvador, to the dictator Bukele is down there, who got $6 million and placed in a concentration camp in El Salvador. And this is a terrible thing that El Salvador has done, you know.
Yes. As a matter of fact, we did a whole show just a few weeks ago on the politics of tattoos themselves and how the government is using it to demonize and marginalize people of color, especially migrants during this time. You may have answered my next question here, but it's pretty clear that everything you're telling us right now is a far cry from the media narrative that we see in corporate media. So despite this information that you have presented to us, people like Secretary of State Marco Rubio are still pushing the false narrative, even against the assessment from intelligence officials saying otherwise, which you also mentioned in your article. Here is Rubio's own assessment on CBS's Face the Nation this past weekend. So let's take a listen.
Do you accept the intelligence community's assessment that the Venezuelan gang is not a proxy force of the Maduro government? That was the National Intelligence Council assessment.
Yeah, that's their assessment. They're wrong. One of the warnings out there by the FBI is not simply that Tren de Aragua are a terrorist organization, but one that has already been operationalized to murder an opposition member in another country.
But that's a different thing than being a proxy force controlled by the Maduro government. Part of this is at the heart of the legal arguments the administration is having over its ability to continue to deport suspected gang members. That's why this assessment is so key. You completely reject that intelligence community finding?
Yeah, I agree 100% with the FBI's finding. This is a prison gang that the Venezuelan government has actively encouraged to leave the country. A prison gang that in some cases they've been in cooperation. And by the way, Tren de Aragua members that have been returned to Venezuela on some of these planes that have gone back have been greeted like heroes at the airport. There's no doubt in our mind and in my mind and in the FBI's assessment that this is a group that the regime in Venezuela uses, not just to try to destabilize the United States, but to project power like they did by murdering a member of the opposition in Chile.
So this is Marco Rubio's distortion of reality that we just heard here. Wherever this portion of the story lands, one thing is clear, and you mentioned this already, innocent people with no criminal records are the ones being deported and sent to El Salvador's Sicar prison without due process. I wonder if you could expand on what a U.S. judge described as, quote-unquote, Nazis receiving better treatment during World War II than it did to hundreds of Venezuelans deported over alleged gang ties, because I think you also cited ABC News in that very quote from a U.S. judge.
You know, forget that they're Venezuelans, okay? The people of the United States have to understand that this is a group of people, you could call them whatever you like, that inside your country, you, the country that goes on about being the beacon of democracy, the people in authority have trashed one of the most important pillars of the rule of law in any democracy. Even if what this guy Rubio had said was true, which is not, by the way, Rubio has never even been in Venezuela. He doesn't even know what he's talking about. But suppose it was true. You have to prove it in a court. You have to have, and you can't just say it like he's spouting this kind of thing. Show me what evidence you have of what you have just said. He has no evidence. There is no evidence. What they want to do is just lay it on to the government of Maduro because they want to overthrow the government. And why is this? Have you thought? Why is the government of the United States, the powerful United States, all these important people, why are they so, you know, concentrated on doing all these terrible things to Venezuela? Well, the answer is, I'm sure you know, it's oil.
Yes.
And so they have thrown everything they can at Venezuela. I'll never say this again. Once I said they have thrown so many sanctions and terrible things at us, what else can they do? Well, I'll never say that again, because this is what else they have done. They have criminalized these poor people who went to the United States thinking that they could get a better life, because life is terrible. The terrible things that the sanctions have done in Venezuela have been horrendous. We're only now, you know, having our head above water, but the sanctions have been very terrible. People's lives, you know, they're seeking a better life. I understand that for them. But the point that I am trying to make is that this is a dangerous thing for you, the citizens of the United States. This that has happened to the Venezuelans can happen to any one of your groups that, you know, whoever is in Washington decides, oh, this group is bad, that group is bad, okay? Because it is going against a pillar of democracy, a pillar of what the rule of law in any real democracy is, which means, you know, a dictator is the one who says, oh, you're guilty, into jail, or off with your head, right? Well, in a democracy, no. You say, oh, I think you've done something wrong. Go before the judge and let us prove that you aren't innocent, that you, in fact, are guilty. None of this has happened. And as I say in my article, don't ask for whom the bells toll, because the bell is tolling for all the citizens of the United States and those who are not citizens, too, because this is a terrible thing, especially for a country of the United States who goes around saying, who's democratic and who isn't, who thinks that they're the judge of other countries. But this is a very bad thing for them. And the other thing that I want to say is I have to say this because I have to denounce the hypocrisy of years and years, members of the United States government and members of the media, the international media, going on about, oh, the poor Venezuelans, their human rights are being violated by Chavez and by Maduro. We have to do something humanitarian for the Venezuelans because this terrible government. Well, where are they now? Why aren't they out on the street screaming and shouting over what has happened to the Venezuelans? With our own eyes, we see it on TV. Where are they now when the powerful government of the United States, led by a bona fide authoritarian, I'm sorry to say this to you in case you haven't figured it out, trashes the human rights of Venezuelans? So you see how hypocritical the whole thing is. The only thing that I can tell you is that this goes against the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 10. It goes against the Charter of the United Nations. It goes against the International Criminal Court, the Rome Statute. It goes against the Organization of American States. You name it, this is a violation. And it's an ominous sign. It's an ominous sign for your country because it is a serious blow to democracy, to the rule of law. Now, what is the motivation? What is it all about? This relentless attack, this hyper attack on Venezuela for the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years. Venezuela has done no wrong to the United States. Venezuela has done no wrong to citizens of the United States. Venezuela has not planned an invasion of the United States. Venezuela is a tiny country compared to the United States. The United States is a country of the world. Military, there's no military in the world similar to that. So the idea that Venezuela is somehow, you know, threatens the United States is like, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous, you know. It's laughable that such a small country compared to the United States with such a small, you know, military or whatever could possibly threaten the United States. But the question is that the United States does not want to pay for Venezuelan oil. It's not content. I mean, Venezuelans want to sell the oil. They can't eat oil. What they want to do is sell it. But the United States wants full control of that oil. It wants to control it, and it wants to control the government. Because this small country of black, brown, mixed, and indigenous peoples have dared to say to the world, we're sovereign, we're independent, we want to decide by ourselves the form of governance that we want in our own destiny. And so the powers that be say, how dare you? Venezuela will not accept tutelage from the United States. And it's most unfortunate that in this day and age, the United States still wants to go on about the Monroe Doctrine that says that Latin America and the Caribbean, you know, is theirs, you know, that this region is somehow the domain of the United States. Venezuela will never accept that.
Going back to the issue of oil, I'll take it a step further, that any news article or news conversation on television or anywhere that does not mention the history of U.S. hostility towards Venezuela, having oil as the central point of all of it, is not telling the whole story.
Cool.
So I always make it a goal to point out the issue of oil whenever I discuss these sort of stories with regards to Venezuela. So I want to go back to these right-wing characters that you mentioned, Machado and Leopoldo López. And one of the things that I've seen that I think is also sort of a false equivalency here, and I've seen this in recent news articles lately, is making the comparison between the demonization of Venezuelan migrants today with Cubans during the Mario boat lift of the late 70s and early 80s. And so it seems like an absurd parallel, but it's a parallel that's being made by the right wing in the U.S. And Donald Trump and many people in his administration are of that time period that they remember, that particular time period when there was a wave of Cuban migrants during that time and how they were demonized in the press and by the government during that time. And so what do you make of this parallel, if it's absurd or if it's a legitimate? Because when it comes to people like Machado and Leopoldo Lopez, I think it was by design that they would go to the Marco Rubios, the Ted Cruzes, the Salazars of the world, because they are Cuban Americans who are able to make that parallel, however absurd or however telling it lays itself in this narrative.
Well, I remember. Right now it's tattoos. Back then it was a beard. If you had a beard, you were the best friend of Fidel Castro, huh? You know, Cuba, our wonderful sister nation, has suffered almost 70 years of sanctions and everything that you can possibly think. Also, all kinds of hybrid war against Cuba. And there she is, Cuba, a light, a beacon of hope for Latin America, because they too withstood. They too said, okay, we won't have a piece of bread. Okay, we won't have a tractor. We'll have an oxen. We won't have this, but we'll have the other. And they survived because they saw that the perils that they were confronting were external. It was an external enemy that was making them suffer. The same exact thing has happened in Venezuela. They thought they'd overthrow Chavez or Maduro. Maduro is the one who's had this tremendous attack at him. And the people are not idiots. They know, you know, we're suffering here, but it's not the government who has done this to us. It's the United States and all its allies who have thrown all these sanctions, who arm these mercenaries, who throw these bombs at us, that have these mercenaries, that have the drone attacks, that bring these people, supposedly a humanitarian, and they're filled with bombs to so they can explode us. I mean, so what has happened? The idea of the sanctions was it was going to bring regime change. People would be really angry and they'd overthrow the government. Well, no, the Venezuelan people, like the Cuban people with Fidel Castro and Raul Castro, have rallied around their government. They said, look, this is an external enemy that's laid siege to us. You know, this isn't the government. The government has tried many things. Every time he tried one thing, the United States would counter with something else. So this has been, you know, a to and fro. But I must admit, and I must say, that it is good news. It is good news for Venezuela. We went through a period where the inflation at one point, I think, was 129% per month. This was 2019. You can't even imagine what, I mean, right now we say, oh, inflation's gone up 1%. Oh, inflation's gone up 2%, we say here in these countries. Well, this was 191% a month in 2019. But it wasn't just economics. 100,000 Venezuelans at least have died because we could not buy food in the international market. But most of all, we could not buy medicines. You know, if you have cancer, there are these medicines that have been, you know, elaborated in big laboratories. You can't just sort of say, oh, well, we can make the same thing here. They're all patented, so you have to buy them. Well, I myself, one of my very dearest cousins, my first cousin, she died. She had cancer because they could not get the medicine that could have at least deterred that cancer. And like her, there were so many, you know. If you needed insulin, there was no insulin. We celebrated when a huge plane from China arrived full of insulin for the people of Venezuela. If you had AIDS, well, you're dead, because those viral sort of medicines that you can give people who have HIV and keep prolong their life, we couldn't get them. But worst of all, and this is something that is hard to forgive, in the middle of a world pandemic, they stopped Moderna and Pfizer from selling vaccines to Venezuela. So Venezuela would not have had vaccines if it wasn't for Russia and China, and then later Cuba, that brought their vaccines to the country. This is unimaginable cruelty. And we have had that with the sanctions.
It is cruelty, and it is criminal as well. And we're going to take a break right here, but I just want to say this about sanctions. that much like oil, any conversation with regards to Venezuelan migrants without mentioning the impacts of sanctions on Venezuela is not telling the whole story. Because as you just described, sanctions can kill and has killed in places like Venezuela. I always make the comparison for people who probably remember the 90s of how sanctions adversely affected people in Iraq. You know, before the lead up to the war in 2003, there were economic sanctions in Iraq that led to a lot of deaths from preventable diseases and illnesses because of a lack of access to medicines during the 1990s.
Yes.
And that was imposed by the United States. And we're seeing it imposed in much the same way in Venezuela today. So we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Maria Paez Victor. She is a Venezuelan-born sociologist living in Canada. Her recent article in Counterpunch is entitled, Where Are the Defenders of the Human Rights of Venezuelans? This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Andan de rodillas por dinero, vende patria viles traicioneros, lacayos rastreros del gran invasor.
Traidores,
porque al pueblo siempre lo engañaron, lo burlaron y discriminaron, y lo asesinaron en calles y prisiones.
Y lo son,
porque anhelan con toda su alma ver la bota imperial con sus armas pisándole el alma a nuestra nación.
Y son
sinvergüenzas, malinques, confesos, han perdido el honor y por eso venden por un peso nuestra dignidad. La historia a esta patria tan llena de gloria, sagrada memoria del libertador.
Traidores,
con su llanto y las canas quedarán, pero ustedes jamás volverán a pisar al pueblo, jamás volverán.
Y lo son,
porque anhelan con toda su alma ver la bota imperial con sus armas pisándole el alma a nuestra nación. Sinvergüenzas, malinques, confesos, han perdido el honor y por eso venden por un peso nuestra dignidad.
Colorín colorado,
historia y la jodienda se les ha acabado.
Colorín, colorín colorado,
no volverán, el pueblo se los ha jurado.
Colorín colorado,
el pueblo no primero ya se ha liberado.
Colorín colorín.
That was Los Guaraguao, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone, you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking with Maria Paez Victor, who is a Venezuelan-born sociologist living in Canada. Her recent article in Counterpunch is entitled, Where Are the Defenders of the Human Rights of Venezuela? Going back to the Marco Rubio clip that we heard in the first half of the show, he mentioned something about Venezuelans being greeted as heroes when they return to Venezuela, which is another one of his ways of demonizing Venezuelan migrants, assuming that the government in Venezuela is greeting terrorists or however he describes it. But in your article, there is a program called Return to the Homeland. I wonder if you could explain this for people who don't know, because this is something else that's been left off the narrative when it comes to, at the very least, humanizing migrants, whether it be Venezuelan or otherwise.
We have a wonderful poet that in about 1890, I think it was, or maybe it was 1900, wrote a beautiful poem called Vuelta a la Patria. It's about a man who has gone away from Venezuela, and then after many years, he comes back. he comes back and it's sad because his mother and father are dead, but he is so happy to return home. So what the government has done, and I don't know any other country in the world who would have done this, after all these migrants went to these right-wing countries, Colombia, Peru, Ecuador, Chile, because this was a campaign. These countries collaborated with La Machado and Borges and to tell these people, go to these countries. You know, you will have a nice life there. Of course, they didn't have any nice life there because none of these countries had any kind of program for them to come and find a job or be rehabilitated so that they could get a job there or anything. Many of them were living on the street, but most of all, they suffered from xenophobia. The people in those countries were really angry at them, okay? So the government of President Maduro said any Venezuelan that wants to return to his home, we will help them. And he sent big planes, Venezuelan planes, to these countries. And all the people had to do was go to a consulate and said, I want to go home. That's all they had to do. They didn't have to pay a single cent. They just said, I want to go home. And so these planes have been coming and you know, hundreds and hundreds of them have come back from Venezuela. I'm sorry, I don't have the exact number here, but just this week, there was about 150 arrived in one of those planes. And so Maduro has also said, we will send our planes to the United States. You don't have to pay for them. We will bring them home. And so this is the Vuelta a la Patria program. I want to tell you something about Mr. Rubio and the kind of person he is, a despicable person, because he was the one who, when this Venezuelan mother holding her 1.5-year-old baby girl was about to enter one of these planes to go home, he had the baby torn from her arms, a little girl. The mother went hysterical, crazy. She was shoved into the plane. And she had to go to Venezuela, and the whole country was absolutely going crazy over return this baby, return this baby. It was this week that this little girl, after almost, I don't know how many months and months, she was shoved from one foster home to another. The mother did not know where she was. And it was through the good offices of Mr. Richard Grenell, who had been a man that was sent to Venezuela to do an exchange of prisoners. It was yes. through him. He got to speak to Trump, and they also spoke to the United Nations. And it was through this Mr. Grenell that this baby was returned home this week. So I have absolutely no respect for Marco Rubio. And to listen to his lies, a man who has never been to Venezuela, who has no way to know what the Trindade is, all he said was a bunch of lies. When these people come back from Venezuela in these planes, especially the ones who have escaped the United States and come home, sure enough, the people are happy and they clap and they say, wonderful, they've come back. But that isn't all. They are also given a very deep interrogation by the authorities, by the Minister of Justice and his people. And through that, they have discovered some people who were wanted in Venezuela because they were thieves or something like that. And those that were wanted, well, they go to the courts. You know, they're taken there. Not all of them, but there have been, you know, you have a load of 50 people and then maybe two or three maybe were wanted or, you know, had something to do with the. But none of them, the Trindade, because there is no Trindade. Okay, this is the big lie. So Marco Rubio is banking. He's banking on a reputation to want to even really now overthrow the government of Maduro. I don't know how he's going to do it. Who's going to overthrow the government of Maduro? Has he got the, you know, an army that's going to do it? Because the army in Venezuela is completely loyal. And so I don't know what his game is.
Yeah, we did a whole show on Marco Rubio as well in his position as Secretary of State. And in my opinion, I totally agree with you. He is Fulgencio Batista reincarnated right now in this Trump administration. Now, I have to say that as the son of Salvadoran immigrants, we can't have this conversation without mentioning Nayib Bukele, the current authoritarian president of El Salvador, and the absurd position that he has taken in this whole criminal scheme of demonizing Venezuelan migrants. And this past April, it was reported that he had gone so far to propose like a prisoner exchange. That's the polite way to say it. A prisoner exchange, which is more like extortion of Venezuelan migrants in the Sicaut prison, you know, obviously for money, but also in exchange for political prisoners in Venezuela. You'll forgive me. I'm a little embarrassed to ask you this, but last time I checked, Venezuela's not at war with El Salvador. And so this proposal, at first glance, is pretty absurd for the president of El Salvador to ask for political prisoners, Venezuelan political prisoners, quote unquote, to be released in exchange for Venezuelan migrants who have, up to this point, have no criminal records and no due process as well. And at first glance, I say because Nayib Bukele does have a public relations background, and he has had relations with right-wing Venezuelans who have helped him with regards to his media relations. So there is something under the surface, but that doesn't take away the absurdity of him acting as a deputy here for the Trump administration. I'm curious to get your thoughts on Bukele in this whole criminal scheme here.
He's an embarrassment to Latin America, not just to El Salvador. But he has truly besmirched the heroic, I would say, tradition and history of Latin America, especially Central America, and all of the many people who have given their lives for the dignity and the independence of El Salvador, of Guatemala, of Mexico, of the entire Caribbean and Latin America. I think that he is a man who really, I hate to say this, but he really doesn't have roots in El Salvador. He really doesn't understand his own country and his own history, because if he did, he'd never act like this. So I think he's a very ignorant man, and he is very dangerous, of course, and he has found wonderful partners in the fascist, I say leaders of the opposition of Venezuela, but they're leaders of nothing. These international criminals, which is what I call Maria Corina Machado and Leopoldo López and Juan Guaido, they have robbed Venezuela of absolute billions. And by the way, they've also robbed the United States, because they received a substantial amount of millions from USAID and pocketed them. USAID is no more, but before it was no more, it acknowledged that the money that they had given to Juan Guaido, they don't know what happened to it. It was ill spent in terrible things, which I am embarrassed to talk about. But what I want to say is that I think that Bukele's political life is not going to be very long, nor his legacy. I don't think that the people of El Salvador, who have truly suffered immensely during those terrible years, are going to accept this. And I have every hope that his terms will be short and his legacy will be nil in the dustbins of history. I want to say that there are no political prisoners in Venezuela. Everyone who's in a prisoner in Venezuela has gone through a trial and has had the benefit of lawyers. You know, I have to tell you this. Ever since we had a new constitution, that was the grand thing that Hugo Chavez did. When he was elected in the year 1999, he put his hand on the old constitution and he said, I swear on this moribund constitution, this dying constitution, that I will carry on my duties and whatnot. Because his campaign was that we were going to have a new constitution, because the old constitution was created by the elites and it had all kinds of terrible things in it. So Venezuela had one of the most progressive, it still has, one of the most progressive constitutions in the region for certain. And it was written in ordinary Spanish. It wasn't legalese. You know, sometimes lawyers write in a way that you really don't understand what they're talking about. This was, if you know Spanish, you can read the constitution and you can understand it. Well, the Venezuelan people became real experts on the constitution. Everybody has a constitution in a little booklet this big, everybody in their pockets, in their handbags. And so Venezuelans are very legalistic. They will tell you article so-and-so and article so-and-so, and they become real legal experts on their own constitution, which is really hilarious because, you know, in these countries that we live in, you know, you say, oh, the constitution, people, you know, roll their eyes and say, you know, I haven't read that. But the question of political prisoners in Venezuela is not existent. If there are prisoners, it's because they committed some crime that they went to the judge. There was a trial and they were convicted. So that is not political prisoners. But I also want to say something. Venezuela has never gone to war. The only time that Venezuelan troops have left Venezuela to go to another country was as the Army of Liberation. And it went under Simón Bolívar, and it liberated from the Spanish Empire, Colombia, Ecuador, Bolivia, Peru, and of course, Panama didn't exist because it was part of Colombia. So the only time that the Venezuelan army has ever left the country was not against a war against a neighbor. It was against an empire, and it was the Army of Liberation. We have never gone to war, and it's a great sort of pride that we are not an aggressive country that wants to go to war against them. Even now, with what ExxonMobil is trying to do in Guyana, you know, Venezuelans are saying, look, this isn't Guyana doing this. This is ExxonMobil. ExxonMobil has put Guyana in its pocket.
Once again, everything that we've discussed here is a far cry from the corporate media narrative that would give people the impression here in the U.S. that Venezuela is about to take over all of Latin America and take over all of the Western Hemisphere. All this fear and paranoia and exaggeration that is nowhere close to the reality that we discussed during the course of this conversation. What is reality, though, is the demonization of Venezuelan migrants. Even as we have this conversation this week, the Trump administration has stripped the protected status of close to 350,000 migrants, most of them Venezuelans, which unfortunately gives me the impression that this demonization is only going to get worse before it gets any better. And so one of the things I'm going to do with this conversation is create a Twitter link to your article in Counterpunch so people can learn more, not only about the demonization of Venezuelan migrants, but also the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which you also put in your article as well. And so usually I ask guests, what else do you hope people learn from your recent article? But again, at the same time, it seems like things are only going to get worse before they get any better here in the U.S. with regards to this dehumanization of Venezuelan migrants. And before you answer it, I just want to say this as well, that the Biden administration is equally culpable with this narrative of demonizing Venezuelan migrants, because it didn't start with Trump alone. There are a lot of years and a lot of time before this second Trump administration that set this demonization of Venezuelan migrants in motion.
Yes, you're quite right. It was Obama. It was Obama who said that Venezuela posed a threat to U.S. security. And everybody laughed. Everyone said, what? The Venezuelans are going to go and march on Washington? What is this ridiculous? Everybody thought, what, he's gone crazy. No, the reason he said that was because if there is a threat to the security, then the president of the United States can take all sorts of measures without going to Congress. And this is what, of course, especially what Mr. Trump has done, that he can do all these things because he doesn't have to go to Congress, because he said, oh, they're invading us. The Venezuelans are invading us. Remember when he said that the migrants were eating pets in somewhere? I mean, they're inventing all of this so that then the president can take all of these measures without going through Congress. This is very dangerous, again, for the United States, because your representatives are in Congress. They represent the people. And if the people are being pushed aside by a president, whichever president, who says, oh, no, look, you know, I'm going to decree this and I'm going to decree that. You have a president who's governing by decree. And so what is happening to the people that you voted for, your representatives in Congress? This is, again, a very dangerous thing for you. But I want to say something to you, that I want to emphasize this. In Venezuela, we don't have a mass of people because the people are all organized. We have what is called communal councils and communes. And that is that any group of people in any local area can become a communal council. And that communal council then is the one to decide the kind of things that that community needs. Like, for example, it needs roads, or it needs water pipes, or it needs a school. And so the communal councils and the communes are the ones that have been very central to the survival of Venezuela. The rural communes are the ones who have fed Venezuela, because from being a country that we needed to buy food, we are now a country that 85% of what we eat is made in Venezuela, is grown in Venezuela, and we are even exporting food. And this has been done not by a government that sort of, you know, plans it and tells people you do this, you do the other. No, these are this grassroots, I would say, network of, we have almost 50,000 communal councils and about 5,000 communes, which are the representatives of the communal councils. And so that has been something that is so beautiful. If any of you go to Venezuela, go visit a communal council, because this is the people in motion. I was talking with the mayor, because the municipality is still there. And so I said to the mayor, well, how does that work? That you're the mayor and you have municipal councils, but at the same time, you have the communal councils out there. How do you make decisions? And he said, well, you know, we in the municipality may say, you know, we really need to pave some of the streets because they need to be paved. And the representatives say that. But it's the communal councils who will say what streets are going to be paved. So you see, they at the beginning, they didn't know how to work. But now, after all these years, they really work together very, very well. It is a form of, if you like, of public participation. And nobody is, you know, you don't have to belong to the government party or the opposition party or anything like that. This is truly public participation. Why? Because the Venezuelan democracy is called a participatory democracy. And I want to say one last thing. They used to say that, oh, Cuba is a dictatorship because there are no elections. Actually, there were elections, but this is what they said. There are no elections. And then Venezuela, who has elections practically every year, oh no, those elections, you know, they don't work. You know, those are not true. Since 1999, we've had 32 elections. The next elections is the end of this month. Elections for governors, elections for deputy of the assembly. We have elections for president. The elections have all kinds of parties. I think there's about 35 political parties that are joining in this. There's about 6,000 candidates. And how is that not democracy? How is that not democracy when we have international people, international witnesses going to Venezuela and saying, yes, it was a good election. There was no shenanigans. There was no problem. It all went, actually, it went even better than your elections, because in 24 hours, we knew who had won. But, you know, it doesn't matter. They will say whatever they want about Venezuela. And Venezuela just says, we're carrying on. We have our government, and we have come out of the tunnel now.
Your passion and conviction and insight to breaking down the false narrative here in the U.S. of not only Venezuela, but Venezuelan migrants is enough to say that we got to have you on the show back again very soon in the near future. And so with that said, we're about out of time. We've been speaking with Maria Paez Victor. She's a Venezuelan-born sociologist living in Canada. Her recent article, Encounter Punch, is entitled, Where Are the Defenders of the Human Rights of Venezuelans? And like I said before, we're going to create a link on our Twitter account so people can read more on this fantastic article. But in the meantime, Maria Paez Victor, it's been insightful and enlightening. Thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Thank you. Un abrazo muy solidario. Muchísimas gracias. Thank you.
Igualmente. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
for WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Friday, May 23rd. Here are some headlines. At least 60 people were killed by Israeli strikes across Gaza in a 24-hour period, Gaza's health ministry said today, as Israel pressed ahead with its escalated military offensive that began earlier this week. This comes as the threat of famine in Gaza continues. Israel agreed this week to allow a minimal amount of aid into the Palestinian territory after blocking the entry of all food, medicine, and fuel since March 2nd. But senior United Nations officials warned that what is being provided is nowhere near enough to forestall the worsening humanitarian crisis. Today, while speaking to reporters in New York, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told reporters, quote, all the aid authorized until now amounts to a teaspoon of aid when a flood of assistance is required. The needs are massive and the obstacles are staggering, close quote. In other news, the Trump administration filed a motion in a California court yesterday to end a longstanding agreement that offers protections to child migrants in federal custody. The Flores Settlement Agreement, which dates back to 1997, requires the government to limit the amount of time children can be detained by immigration officials. It also requires the government to provide children in its custody with adequate food, water, and clean clothes. The Justice Department argues that changes in policy make the Flores Agreement no longer necessary, and the agreement has incentivized illegal border crossings by migrant families and unaccompanied minors. Human rights advocates insist that abolishing Flores would lead to inhumane treatment of detained minors. A hearing is scheduled for mid-July. In more news, a federal judge in San Francisco has indefinitely paused President Trump's sweeping overhaul of the federal government. In an order late last night, U.S. District Judge Susan Ilston barred agencies from mass layoffs pending the outcome of a lawsuit by unions, nonprofits, and municipalities, saying Trump needed permission from Congress before reorganizing federal agencies. The order affects tens of thousands of employees at 22 agencies. This morning, the Trump administration appealed the decision to the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals and will likely ask the court to pause Ilston's ruling pending the outcome of the appeal. And President Trump's plan to bar international students from Harvard University is already facing a hurdle. Noah Portner has the story.
Today, a federal judge temporarily halted the Trump administration's efforts to revoke Harvard's ability to enroll international students. A Boston-based judge ordered a temporary restraining order, agreeing with the university that the government's actions would cause, quote, immediate and irreparable injury, end quote. Over 25% of the undergraduate population at Harvard is from abroad, and if the administration's efforts go through, Harvard will be ineligible to apply for student authorization for at least a year. The Trump administration blames Harvard for the situation, alleging that foreign students colluded with enemies of the U.S., such as Hamas, and created an unsafe environment for Harvard's Jewish population. The president of Harvard has stated that the government's actions were, quote,